Hi, welcome to Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and today we have a special podcast. As you may know, one of Dr. Craig's greatest contributions to philosophy and theology is his development of the Kalam cosmological argument for the existence of God. And if you're not familiar with this fascinating argument for God's existence, today's podcast is a good place to start. And even if you're familiar with the Kalam, this podcast will help synopsize the argument and highlight some basic premises. So let's call this the best of the Kalam cosmological argument. And we begin with Dr. Craig's recent address on a speaking tour in California. As we begin, we'd like to ask that you consider supporting Reasonable Faith. Your tax-deductible financial gifts are a huge blessing to us and supports our work not only on the internet, but on the most influential university and college campuses in the world. Your support helps us keep free content on the web. So if you appreciate Reasonable Faith, please support us. Just go to reasonablefaith.org. And while you're there, be sure and pick up a copy of Dr. Craig's new book, On Guard. It's available for purchase at reasonablefaith.org. Now here's Dr. Craig.
Well, in my article in Christianity Today, the first argument I discussed was a form of the cosmological argument known as the Kalam cosmological argument. First, let me formulate the argument for you. Number one, everything that begins to exist has a cause. Two, the universe began to exist. Three, therefore, the universe has a cause. And once we reach the conclusion that the universe has a cause, then we can analyze what properties a cause of the universe would have to have. Now, premise one, I think, seems obviously true. It's at least more plausibly true than its negation. First and foremost, the premise is rooted in the metaphysical intuition that something cannot come into being out of nothing. To suggest that things could just pop into being uncaused out of nothing is literally worse than magic. It's to quit doing serious philosophy and appeal to magic. Secondly, if things could come into being uncaused from nothing, then it becomes inexplicable why just anything and everything doesn't come into being uncaused from nothing. Why doesn't root beer and Beethoven and bicycles just pop into being uncaused out of nothing? And finally, thirdly, the first premise is constantly confirmed in our experience. We have the strongest of motivations, I think, therefore, to accept the first premise. What about premise two? Well, this can be supported by both philosophical arguments and scientific evidence. The philosophical arguments aim to show that the idea of an infinite regress of events in time is impossible, or, in other words, the number of past events must be finite, and therefore the universe had a beginning. Now, the philosophical arguments for the finitude of the past are fascinating and mind-expanding. The scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe is based on the expansion of the universe. According to the Big Bang model, physical space and time, as well as all matter and energy in the universe, came into being about 13.7 billion years ago in a cataclysmic event known as the Big Bang. Now, what makes the Big Bang so remarkable, so stunning, is that it represents the origin of the universe from literally nothing. As the physicist P.C.W. Davies explains, the coming into being of the universe, as discussed in modern science, is not just a matter of imposing some sort of organization upon a previous incoherent state, but literally the coming into being of all physical things from nothing. Geometrically, we're able to demonstrate that any universe for the years to try to avoid, space-time had a beginning. Now, what makes the Big Bang so remarkable, so stunning, is that it represents the origin of the universe from literally nothing. As the physicist P.C.W. Davies explains, the coming into being of the universe, as discussed in modern science, is not just a matter of imposing some sort of organization upon a previous incoherent state, but literally the coming into being of all physical things from nothing. Now, of course, alternative theories have been crafted over the years to try to avoid the absolute beginning predicted by the Big Bang model. But none of these alternatives has commended itself to the scientific community as more plausible than the Big Bang Theory. In fact, in 2003, Arvind Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin were able to demonstrate that any universe, which is on average in a state of cosmic expansion over its history, cannot be eternal in the past, but had to have an absolute beginning. Vilenkin pulls no punches. This is what he says. It is said that an argument is what convinces reasonable men, and a proof is what it takes to convince even an unreasonable man. With the proof now in place, and by that he means the Bord-Guth-Vilenkin theorem, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning.
You're listening to Reasonable Faith. Thanks so much for being here as we continue with highlights on the Kalam cosmological argument. Dr. Craig had a dialogue on the Kalam with one of its detractors, Wes Morriston. Here, he discusses the interaction.
I gave three reasons in support of the first premise. I said, first of all, that something cannot come out of nothing, that this is a sort of metaphysical first principle, and that if the first premise is false, then that means that things could come into being out of nothing, which seems worse than magic. And his response to that was simply to say, well, those are just synonymous statements, that whatever begins to exist has a cause, something cannot come into being out of nothing, so it doesn't advance the argument. Well, I don't think that's true. I think that the one can provide a deeper explanation for the other and can be more evidently true than the other. Sometimes rewording a claim in a certain way can make it more perspicuous. And I think that the vast majority of people, certainly the vast majority of philosophers, have believed that being doesn't come from non-being, that being only comes from being, and that therefore it is a sort of first principle of metaphysics that something doesn't come from nothing, that it has to have a cause.
Would we say that something cannot come from nothing uncaused?
Right, because and by that you mean uncaused. If you say that something comes into being from nothing via a cause, then you're using the word nothing in a different sense. What you're saying there is there's no material cause of it. Aristotle distinguished between the efficient cause of something, which produces it in being, and the material cause, which is the stuff of which a thing is made. So to say that something is caused to come into being from nothing is quite different. What that is saying is that there is a cause, there is an efficient cause, but there's just no material cause.
I can hear someone saying, well, if something cannot come from nothing, then God can't bring anything from nothing either.
And that would be a misunderstanding, as I say, of the claim, because in the absence of God, what one is saying is there is no efficient cause, there is no material cause, there is no cause whatsoever. Being comes from non-being. But when you say God brought the universe into being without a material cause, that's not a case of being coming from non-being. There, God is a being, he is an actual being, and he produces the universe in existence. So that is very, very different from saying there is no cause whatsoever. In the one case, you're saying there is an efficient cause, but no material cause. In the other case, you're saying there is neither an efficient cause nor a material cause. And that's why I say it is worse than magic. In magic, when the magician pulls a rabbit out of the hat, at least you've got the magician, you see. But on the atheistic view, the universe just pops into being absolutely from non-being, which I think is surely absurd.
Now, his problem with the second premise, don't you think that the evidence is very convincing and growing that the universe,
yes,
in fact, had a beginning?
Yes, I think that's right. And what he did was he went and interviewed some physicists at UC Boulder, and it was very interesting to listen to their statements carefully, because you've got to parse these statements to hear what they're really saying, because I think their statements were accurate, but I don't think they had the implications that Wes thought they did. So, for example, one of the theorists that he interviewed said, we don't have any physical theory of the initial conditions of the universe. And the reason for that is we'd need a quantum theory of gravity. And from that, Wes drew the implication that therefore we don't know that the universe began to exist. And what I pointed out to him is that the theorem developed by Bord, Guth, and Vilenkin in 2003, is independent of any physical description of that early era of the universe. It holds regardless of your quantum theory of gravity, and therefore, the fact that we don't have a theory for describing this early era does nothing to undermine the implication of the finitude of the past, nor did his source say that it did. He simply read into his source an implication it didn't have. Another string theorist that he interviewed said that we cannot be confident or know for sure, something to that effect, that the universe began at the Big Bang. Now, again, that's technically accurate because there are theories developed in pre-Big Bang cosmology, loop quantum gravity, and certain other very speculative fields that would enable you to push back to an era prior to the Big Bang. But again, that doesn't imply that the universe didn't have a beginning, because those theories cannot be extrapolated back to infinity. They still have only a finite past, even if the beginning wasn't at the Big Bang event in the standard model. Nor did his source say that they could be extrapolated to infinity past. Wes was just inferring this from that statement. And I pointed out to him that these models are all surveyed very carefully by Jim Sinclair in the article that he and I have co-authored for the forthcoming Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology, where he goes through these various attempts to avoid the implication of the Bord-Guth-Vilenkin theorem and shows that these cannot be extended to past infinity. So that even if the universe didn't begin at the Big Bang event, as in the standard model, it still had a beginning at some time in the finite past. So that was a very interesting part of the debate, where he brought up these sources from folks that he interviewed and then read into them implications that they didn't really have.
Well, how does Wes Morrison handle infinity then, the impossibility of traversing an actual concrete infinite?
Well, this was very interesting. In response to Hilbert's hotel illustration, which is the illustration devised by the great German mathematician David Hilbert of a hotel that has an infinite number of rooms, but is also fully occupied. So there are no empty rooms anywhere in this infinite hotel. And yet Hilbert shows how by just moving the people around inside the hotel, you can create more vacancies, and without doubling up anybody in any room. You still have just one person per room, and yet you can create room for infinitely new people to come into the hotel. And I point out that that is not only absurd, but then also when people check out of the hotel, it leads to absurdities as well. And what Morrison said was, look, your illustration presupposes that people can move around in the hotel, that they can be moved from, say, room 1 to room 2 and room 2 to room 4 and so forth. But he said events in time are not like that. Events in time are fixed at their dates. You can't move the date of the Declaration of Independence and have it be signed at another date. Times are fixed, and therefore it's disanalogous to Hilbert's hotel. And my response to that was to say, well, Wes, this is just a thought experiment. Let's suppose Hilbert's hotel is a hotel where, say, all the rooms are locked so that people can't move out of them. Or maybe there are no doors to the rooms so that you have an infinite number of rooms, one person in each room, but there's no doors. I said you can still imagine what it would be like for a person in room 1 to be in room 2, and the person in room 2, he could be in room 4, and you'll generate the same absurdities. You don't have to actually go through the trouble of moving the people physically. And he said to me, well, I thought you might say that. And so here's my next response. He said, if the past can't be infinite, then the future can't be infinite as well, which is absurd. And the reason for that is, he said, let's imagine that you will praise God and never cease. You will just keep uttering one praise per minute without ever ending. How many praises will you utter? Well, you will utter an infinite number of praises. And therefore, if an infinite, actual infinite cannot exist in the past, you can't have an actual infinite in the future. You have to say your praises will come to an end, and that's absurd. So your argument proves too much, Bill, he would say. If it proves you can't have an infinite past, then you can't have an infinite future as well. And I said, Wes, you're confusing an actual infinite with a potential infinite. if the series of future praises goes on forever, there will never be uttered an actually infinite number of praises. Rather, infinity serves merely as the limit which you endlessly approach, but you never arrive at. The number of praises is always finite, but it's always increasing toward infinity as a limit. But
it's strange to use the word infinite and limit in the same sentence almost. I mean, it serves as a conceptual limit.
Yes, purely conceptual.
You never get there, but it's perfectly okay to say we'll praise God forever in that it will never cease.
That's right.
One day we will complete an infinite.
Right, or that we will ever utter an infinite number of praises. But you see, Kevin, you can't say that about the past. For the past to be potentially infinite, it would have to be finite but growing in a backward direction. That is, say, growing in the earlier than direction to be the mirror image of the future. And that's crazy. The past isn't growing backwards in the earlier than direction. It's moving forwards in the sense that with the present event, more and more events are being added to the past. So there's a clear asymmetry between the past and the future. So I said to Wes, I agree with you. The future cannot be actually infinite like the past, but it can be potentially infinite, unlike the past. Now, what about God's knowledge of what will happen, however? Are there an infinite number of items of God's knowledge? Well, again, that's not obvious to me. This seems to assume that God's knowledge is propositional in nature. That is to say, that what God knows is an actually infinite number of future tense propositions. But the difficulty there is that it assumes that God's knowledge is propositional in nature. And I don't think that's incumbent upon the theist. In fact, the classical theist has typically denied that God's knowledge is fragmented into propositions, into individual bits of information. Rather, God's knowledge is a seamless whole, an intuition of all reality and all truth, and is therefore non-propositional in nature. We finite knowers fragment God's infinite propositional knowledge into an infinite number, or a potentially infinite number, of finite bits or propositions. But that represents simply our finite expression of what God knows, not the medium by which God himself knows them. And therefore, the number of propositions that exist, if propositions exist at all, would simply be potentially infinite as human cognizers come to formulate and know more and more propositions. But there's no reason to think that God's knowledge has to be propositional in its structure. If it's not, then I don't see that there's any collection of things that is infinite in number. Neither the events themselves are actually infinite in number, nor are the items of God's knowledge actually infinite in number. So there just isn't any case here of an actually infinite number of things, and therefore it's not a counterexample to the argument.
This seems to answer objections to God based on his future knowledge throughout future events. And also prior to creation, prior to the Big Bang, causally prior to the Big Bang, what God was doing throughout all eternity. If you can't traverse an actually infinite number of things, well then God was thinking thoughts all this time prior to creation, and he was thinking an infinite number. But God doesn't, are you saying that God doesn't think thoughts successively one after another like we do?
Well, that would be entailed in what I'm saying, that the series of past events, which could include mental events in God's mind, must be finite and have a beginning. It will get you back to an absolutely changeless state in which there is no succession of before and after. And that would include in the mental life of God himself. God would exist changelessly sans the universe, without the universe.
Thank you so much for listening to Reasonable Faith, and today you've heard excerpts from various podcasts and audio on the Kalam cosmological argument, but the complete versions are available at reasonablefaith.org. We'll be adding new podcasts each week, so be sure you come back. Finally, thank you so much for your financial support. This keeps the ministry of Reasonable Faith expanding. You know, even the name Reasonable Faith gets so many people's attention. They often assume that faith in God is not reasonable or supported by facts and evidence. The name alone can break down unnecessary barriers and bring people to Dr. Craig's work on these crucial questions of life. So check out reasonablefaith.org, click through all the great resources there, and if you wish, you can safely donate there as well. It would be a blessing. We appreciate it. I'm Kevin Harris. We'll see you next time on Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig.